content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Our first article for today is titled, Bhagat Singh Thind's Case Shows the Link Between Whiteness and Citizenship. This article is by Vandana Pawa. The story of Bhagat Singh Thind is the story of how powerful institutions use the concept of whiteness to decide who gets to be a citizen in America. Thind arrived in the United States in 1913, emigrating from his native Punjab, a northern state in modern-day India. Inspired by the works of Emerson and Thoreau, Thind left Punjab at age 21 to further his education in America and attend the University of California at Berkeley, paying his way by working at an Oregon lumber mill. He enlisted in the military as the U.S. entered World War I, serving until he was honorably discharged in 1918. After his discharge, Thind applied for U.S. citizenship in the state of Oregon and was granted naturalization by a U.S. district court in 1920. But as soon as Thind's application was accepted, a naturalization examiner appealed the Oregon court's decision, kicking off what would become a fierce fight to gain citizenship. The main statutes determining eligibility at the time were the Naturalization Act of 1790, which limited naturalization of immigrants to any free white person of good character, and the provisions provided by the Naturalization Act of 1870, which extended naturalization laws to aliens of African nativity and persons of African descent. In 1923, a case before the Supreme Court, Thind argued for his citizenship on the basis of his identification as a high caste Hindu, stating that since he came from the North India, the original home of the Aryan conquerors, then he must also belong to the Caucasian Aryan race. While Thind was actually Sikh, the third Hindu was then used as a racial and geographical designation for everyone from South Asia, rather than a religious designation. Thind chose not to challenge the discriminatory nature of the racial prerequisite itself. He chose to use caste status as a means of aligning himself with whiteness. His choice to use caste status as a means of aligning himself with whiteness can be attributed to the dire circumstances he and other Asian immigrants faced at a time when there was no national immigrant rights movement that could have presented him with any other option. On February 19, 1923, the court unanimously decided against Thind, ruling that people of Indian descent were not white and hence ineligible for naturalization. United States v. Bhagat Singh Thind exists in a long line of white nationalist immigration policy and illustrates how courts constructed whiteness in a way that best aligned with the institutionalized xenophobia they wanted to protect. In ruling against Thind, the Supreme Court actually went against precedent set in a few months just prior in the case Takoa Ozawa v. United States. Takao Ozawa, a Japanese-American man, argued for citizenship based on his skin tone and good character. The courts denied him citizenship on the basis of the contemporary anthropological definitions of Caucasian, claiming that Ozawa was actually Mongolian. Japanese people like him were not free white persons and therefore ineligible for citizenship. Thind argued for his own citizenship based on the same standards, noting that the definition of Caucasian at the time included certain groups from India. Despite this, Thind was denied citizenship. Ignoring the definitions that they used to deny Ozawa citizenship, the court abruptly reconstructed the meaning of the term Caucasian to exclude those from India. In the cases of Thind and Ozawa, the court further limited both the legal and popular understanding of what whiteness is and who can benefit from it, identifying exactly who should be excluded from citizenship and classified as the opposite of white. Around the time of Thind's case, the Ghadar Party, an anti-imperialist revolutionary organization of which Thind was believed to be a founding member, was working toward Indian independence at their western headquarters in San Francisco. The Ghadar Party was made up of Sikh, Hindu, and Muslim revolutionaries seeking to challenge and resist the rule of the British Empire in South Asia, and is credited with laying a foundation for the region's eventual independence from British colonial rule in 1947. During Supreme Court arguments, the government cited evidence of Thind's involvement with the party as a sign that he was a foreign radical, a fact they claimed made him even more unfit for citizenship. In addition to race, the government was seemingly also looking to restrict citizenship only to those who adhered to political views they deemed appropriate and acceptable. After Thind's citizenship was revoked by the Supreme Court in 1923, many other previously naturalized Indians also had their citizenship revoked, losing many rights such as the right to land ownership, along with their citizen status. Following the Thind decision, the Immigration Act of 1924, also known as the Asian Exclusion Act, established a quota system in which immigrant visas were provided to only 2% of the number of people representing each nationality as of the 1890 census, and excluded Asians entirely. It wasn't until the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952 that Asian people were again permitted to migrate to the U.S. and gain citizenship. The tide of immigration policy turned dramatically with the passage of the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965, largely thanks to the civil rights movement and the activism of black leaders who sought to abolish unequal treatment on the basis of race and nationality. The immigrant quota system that had been in place for decades was beginning to seem was beginning to be seen as discriminatory, and the 1965 Act removed previous racial limitations on immigration and citizenship. While the ability to deny citizenship on the basis of race is no longer institutionalized within the American legal system, race and citizenship are still deeply connected. This has been evident throughout the 21st century. Northwestern University political science professor Jacqueline Stevens estimates through her research that approximately 1% of immigrant detainees in more than 8,000 cases between the years 2006 and 2008 were actually U.S. citizens. Data analyzed by NPR in 2016 shows that more than 1,500 citizens spent time in immigrant detention centers between 2007 and 2015. The current presidential administration continues to use Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to police communities. And while ICE has been accused of treating immigrants inhumanely, regardless of documentation status, the connection between race and citizenship remains evident in which citizens ICE chooses to target. In July, three young children were detained by border officers at Chicago O'Hare Airport after returning home from a family trip to Mexico. Despite being U.S. citizens, the same month, an 18-year-old U.S. citizen born in Texas was reportedly detained by ICE for nearly 3 weeks. In both of these instances, the one commonality was race. The detainees were citizens, but they were not white. Bhagat Singh Thind experienced firsthand the policing of who is allowed to benefit from the privilege of U.S. citizenship that is so deeply rooted in the history of this country. While the laws may have changed since Thind's time, the connection between whiteness and citizenship very much persists today. The next article for today is titled Black Wall Street and the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 Explained. This is by Shamara Lawrence. In the summer of 1921, one of the worst episodes of racist violence in American history erupted in the heart of one of the most prosperous black communities in the nation. Dubbed Black Wall Street due to its affluent black residents, the Greenwood neighborhood of Oklahoma, where the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre took place, was a hub of black success, featuring black-owned homes and establishments, including banks, restaurants, and hotels, in a community that included accomplished lawyers, doctors, and dentists. It was one of a few predominantly black areas that thrived economically after the end of the Civil War and into the 20th century, when racial discrimination was the order of the day. The residents of Greenwood faced racism from those in neighboring white communities, and the tension hit a fever pitch on May 31st, when 19-year-old Dick Rowland, who was black, was apprehended by police for allegedly assaulting a 17-year-old white elevator operator, Sarah Page, inside of an office building on South Main Street. Accounts differ as to what occurred between the two. Some say he accidentally stepped on her foot when entering the elevator, causing her to scream. But the encounter sparked widespread outrage among white people who rioted through Black Wall Street. The neighborhood never fully recovered from the incident. After Rowland was arrested, an armed white mob spent 24 hours looting and burning homes, schools, libraries, movie theaters, and other businesses. Eyewitnesses reported seeing planes hovering overhead as buildings burned from the top down on the streets below. Scores of black people were shot and killed by white people, many of whom were given weapons by police. Historians believe as many as 300 people were murdered, but there will probably never be an accurate death toll. According to The Ringer, eyewitnesses say they saw bodies piled onto trucks and dumped in unmarked graves. In the massacre's aftermath, 35 city blocks were left in charred ruins and 10,000 people were homeless. After the rampage, many black Tulsans left the city in fear for their safety, and many black and white residents who remained in Tulsa stayed silent about the tragedy for decades. As time passed, vivid details about the massacre faded. No one was convicted for the incident, including Rowland. To this day, questions about the scope of the attack, including how many people carried out the violence and the degree of government involvement, remain unanswered. I first learned about the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre on Tumblr, sometime during high school, while aimlessly scrolling down my feed. I saw jarring photos of houses engulfed in flames. Despite having taken AP U.S. History in high school, no teacher had taught my classes anything about the destruction of Black Wall Street. I'm not the only one who was left in the dark about this crucial piece of history. The State Department of Education has required the topic be taught in Oklahoma history classes since 2000, but the rampage didn't appear in the state school books until 2009. During President's Day weekend in 2019, I had the opportunity to travel to Tulsa with the George Kaiser Family Foundation, a charitable organization based in the city focused on providing equal opportunities for young children from varied socioeconomic backgrounds. I had few expectations going into the trip, but thought the history of Black Wall Street would at least be well preserved. What I saw was remarkably different. Through talking to Tulsa locals and conducting my own research, I learned more about how the city came to be and how it was the perfect place for a community like Greenwood to flourish. Before Oklahoma was seized from indigenous peoples by colonial settlers, it was a present-day Tulsa. What is present-day Tulsa was inhabited by the Creek. Tulsa's name was lifted from the Creek language, and the city was officially incorporated in 1898. At the turn of the 20th century, Tulsa experienced an oil boom, and its population ballooned from about 1,300 to more than 140,000 residents in 40 years. Seeing a massive economic opportunity, O.W. Gurley, a wealthy Black educator and entrepreneur from Arkansas, who's credited as the earliest pioneer of Black Wall Street, bought 40 acres on the northern outskirts of Tulsa. He sold pockets of the land to African Americans, who developed a small community that eventually blossomed into the success story that's ended so tragically. After the massacre, Greenwood was rebuilt from the ground up and was thriving again by the 1940s. However, the progress was short-lived. The Black dollar no longer stayed in the community, as Black people had more options to shop in other places and took their patronage elsewhere. This weakened the strength of Black-owned businesses and the financial stability of the neighborhood overall. Then, urban renewal projects of the 1960s raised substandard buildings, including those in Greenwood, which were torn down to create a new highway. All over the city, small businesses were squeezed out by large retailers, but Black business owners were especially affected, as architect Joe L. Robinson, who designed a restoration project in the neighborhood, told the Oklahoman in 1985. As a result, by the end of the 1970s, little remained of the original district. In the decades since the Tulsa race massacre, Black residents continue to grapple with countless inequities. Today, many of the city's low-income Black people reside on the north side, with second-rate housing and a dearth of grocery stores, and white communities inhabit the bustling Midtown and South Side. Such disparities affect overall quality of life, job opportunities, and life expectancy. When I visited the area, it looked to me like Williamsburg, a gentrified neighborhood in Brooklyn. There appeared to be a lack of Black-owned businesses and plenty of new establishments, but there are countless community leaders, activists, and artists in Tulsa who I met during my four-day trip who are all glimmers of hope in keeping the spirit of Black Wall Street alive. In 2018, on North Greenwood Avenue, Rico Wright opened the Black Wall Street Gallery to showcase the work of local Black visual artists, some of whom belong to the artists' collective, Black Moon. Through the power of art, Wright aims to use the space to not only display art, but also to facilitate dialogue between white and Black communities grappling with the city's racist past. At the end of the day, we have to find ways to rectify issues of yesteryear. We can't overlook our history, he tells Teen Vogue. It's affecting all of us. It's not just Black people affected by the massacre. There were white people affected by it, too. The history has been concealed for decades. All of us have been affected. One of the few places left partially intact after the massacre was Vernon Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church. As in most Black communities, the church served as a sacred space for worship, but also a place for healing. Several people tried to buy us out, but we still have been able to manage financially, Reverend Dr. Robert Turner, the new pastor of historic Vernon AME Church, told us on the trip as he stood in one of the rooms that had been untouched since the 1920s. There's recently been a resurgence in membership, and we thank God for it. As long as I'm here, this is where we will be. Being able to tour that space was an honor, but it also deeply saddened me to see that out of all of the places that once existed in the neighborhood, that was one of very few that were still standing. Black Tulsans deserve better. Meanwhile, the city continues its rebirth, reconciling its dark past. Brady Street, a major road in the downtown area that was named after W. Tate Brady, one of the city's founders and a former Klansman, was in 2018 renamed Reconciliation Way. That same year, Kansas City artist Scribe Ross was commissioned to paint a mural near the Greenwood Center, near the Greenwood Cultural Center, to commemorate Black Wall Street. Many of the Black Tulsans I met were passionate about reclaiming the narrative about what happened to their ancestors. Instead of referring to the destruction of Greenwood as a race riot, as it was originally labeled, primarily so insurance companies didn't have to pay for the burned homes and businesses, and implying both parties were fighting each other, they now insist we call it what it actually was, a massacre, which I believe truly illustrates what happened. Additionally, some of the community groups I spoke with on the ground shared in the hope of seeing the city pay reparations for the massacre, but acknowledged the difficulty of getting monetary retribution for victims of the event since one of the last remaining survivors passed away last year. In 2003, when the Reparations Coordinating Committee tried to get reparations for those who had lost homes and businesses in the attack, the United States District Court for Northern Oklahoma dismissed their lawsuit, essentially saying it was too late to seek justice for what happened. As a nation, it's due time we tell the truth about what happened to the residents of Greenwood. During its peak, Black Wall Street was a symbol of Black achievement, filled with successful Black people from all walks of life. Their legacies and resilience deserve to be honored in that same vein. And our last article for today, How Podcasting Helped Me Cope with Pandemic Loneliness, by Olivia Ho. Like many teens, I've been more lonely than ever during this pandemic. The most obvious symptom of my loneliness is how I've started talking to myself. I can be found muttering to myself in my room, when I'm folding laundry, and in between my Zoom classes. I frequently embarrass myself in my daily walks when I realize that my voice has gone above its normal whisper. My one-sided conversations are often discussions with friends that I act out in my head. Strangely, I've begun to see myself as a friend, albeit one that I'm getting extremely tired of. But I'm glad that I can at least keep myself company as I complete my mind-numbing, boring daily routine. Each day, I wake up and take a long walk around my neighborhood before I sit alone at my desk and attend my Zoom classes. During remote school, I'm constantly texting my friends as I listen to my teacher speak. Texting is the most social interaction I get during school. Like every other student in my class, I rarely turn on my camera. In the afternoons, I continue to work or slack offline, and my social life is every 18-year-old's dream. The highlight of my day is watching Jeopardy with my parents at 7:30 each night. I go to bed around 11 and repeat everything upon waking up. In the absence of the regular social interactions, I seem to have lost my social skills. I never used to have trouble connecting with others before the pandemic. I could easily strike up a conversation with my classmates and teachers. Now, however, it seems like every conversation I try to start inevitably becomes a bummer. I don't really know how to respond to a polite, "How are you?" I know they aren't expecting me to be honest, so I awkwardly avoid an answer when I'm asked. My desire to connect with others often leads me to social media, which makes me feel even more alienated. On Instagram, my friends and classmates post pictures of their hikes or backyard hangouts and leave comments referencing exciting adventures. They seem to have more freedom than I do, which is understandable. My family has been under strict quarantine since last March due to my parents' high-risk heart condition. When I see pictures of an unsocial distant gathering, I can't help but feel bitter and frustrated. How can other people be so happy when I'm quietly suffering? How can my peers be so casually flout? How can my peers so casually flout COVID protocols during this crisis? One of the only outlets I have to express myself is through this teenage life. Over 2 years ago, Molly Josephs, a teacher at my school, asked me if I wanted to help start an after-school podcasting club. After I recruited my friends, we gathered around a microphone twice a week to record our thoughts on topics we found meaningful, including coming out, middle school, and first impressions. Our conversations were loud, rambunctious, and an adventure to edit. As we started to create the show, we were also building a community, one of the only consistent communities I'm a part of that has withstood quarantine. When the pandemic hit, the podcast group was scattered around San Diego, and Molly had moved to the East Coast. Despite the distance, we started to video chat almost every day. As we slowly came to terms with the lockdown and realized we couldn't be returning to school anytime soon, we produced more episodes on topics like using boredom as a creative force, our anxiety over the election, and maintaining friendships during quarantine. When I enter this teenage life recording sessions, I feel like I'm casually hanging out in a group of friends again. I talk enthusiastically into my microphone, watch my friends laugh, and freely share my thoughts. Throughout the quarantine, our community has continued to grow. We've connected with young people across the world and created a series of episodes with a group of young women from Kabul, Afghanistan. This teenage life has filled the void where my social connections at school used to be. While the pandemic has heightened our loneliness, people in contemporary society have already been struggling with isolation and alienation. Beyond the pandemic, we need to think consciously about how to create community and build spaces for young people to connect to others in sustaining and intentional ways. For me, this teenage life is where I go to have meaningful conversations and connect with people in an intentional way, especially now that I don't have access to those interactions in my everyday life. Through making the podcast and interacting with our listeners, I've come to understand that even if I'm lonely, at least in my loneliness, I am not alone. Okay, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.